Thank you for listening to a message from the Manhattan Church of Christ. The following sermon was recorded during our Sunday morning worship service. The notes for this sermon are available on our website at www.manhattanchurch.org/sermon-notes. We hope that this message will be helpful to you and encourage you to explore the Word of God. And now, this week's message.
Good morning, church. My name is Autumn, and I'll be reading Luke chapter 23, verses 1 through 25. Then the whole crowd in the Sanhedrin rose and brought Jesus before Pilate. They started by making this accusation against him. "We discover this man is corrupting our nation and forbidding paying tribute taxes to Caesar and claiming that he himself is Messiah, our anointed king." So Pilate asked him directly, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus answered him, "You're the one saying that." Then Pilate said to the chief priests in the crowds, "I'm not finding any criminal guilt in this person." But they began pushing harder, saying, "He's inciting unrest among the people by teaching through all Judean regions, starting from Galilee to here." When Pilate heard this, he asked if the man was a Galilean. And when he found that he was from Herod's domain, he sent him to Herod Antipas, the ruler of Galilee, since he was in Jerusalem for the feast days. Now when Herod saw Jesus, it made him very happy, since for a long time he'd wanted to see him. He had heard all about Jesus, and he was hoping to see some miraculous sign done by him. So Herod interrogated him with many questions, but Jesus said not a word in answer. But the chief priests and the scribes were sitting close by, heatedly accusing him. So when Herod and his bodyguards had treated Jesus with disdain and mocked him by dressing him up in fancy clothes, Herod sent him back to Pilate. It so happened that Herod and Pilate became friendly with each other that very day, though in the past they had been enemies to each other. So Pilate summoned the chief priests, the rulers, and the people, and he addressed them. "You brought me this man, accusing him of leading the people to revolt. But look, after I myself examined him in front of you, I didn't find this man guilty of any of your accusations against him. And neither did Herod, since he sent him back to us. Look, no crime worthy of death has been done by him. Therefore, I'm going to scourge him for disciplinary punishment and release him." But they all cried out together, "Take him away, release Barabbas from us." Barabbas was someone who was thrown into jail because of an insurrection that had just erupted in the city and for a killing. Again, and Pilate spoke to them because he really preferred to release Jesus. But they kept shouting over him, "Crucify, crucify him." Yet a third time he said to them, "Why? What evil crime did he commit? I didn't find any crime deserving death in him. So I'm going to discipline him and then release him." But the throng shouted with even louder voices, demanding for Jesus to be crucified, and their voices were overpowering. So Pilate rendered his verdict that the crowd's demand should be granted. He released the man who had been thrown into jail because of insurrection and murder, and the one they demanded, but Jesus he handed over for their will to be carried out.
I hope that you have a copy of the sheet that has the notes for the message today. If you don't, there's some being handed out here. Thank you, Keith. I appreciate it very much. Because I want us to be looking at the narrative as it is there in the scripture. I'm so glad that Emily picked that a song that we just sang a moment ago, "Where Across the Crowded Ways of Life." In many ways, that could be the title of this message. That in the story of Jesus and his trial, you have the crossing of the crowded ways of life. And we learn something as we see these crowded ways of life crashing together, helping each other, interacting, elbowing each other in all of this. It's rather a surprising narrative as we come to the story of Jesus' trial. We actually entered it last week. And at the top of the backside of your sheet, if you've got that, we have at least a small selection from the last part of our text from last week as Jesus was questioned in the Sanhedrin room, in the Sanhedrin hall, in the temple, by the temple leaders, and so forth. And they are convinced that he needs to die. And so they take him off to Pilate. And that's where our text for today begins. As we've followed through this, if you look on the front side of your sheet, you'll see that this message is part of a series. I've mentioned this several times recently, but it's a part of a series entitled Luke, Anointed with God's Spirit, namely Jesus is anointed with God's Spirit, number 67. So we're at 67 in the whole series. Next Sunday is Palm Sunday, which usually is celebrating the triumphal entry into Jerusalem. And we're going to take something of that story, not the whole of it, but some important parts of it as Jesus came into the city. And we're going to pair it up with Jesus' crucifixion, which comes toward the end of that week. Palm Sunday is the beginning of what we often refer to as Holy Week, or the week of Jesus' last week in his ministry and his teaching before his crucifixion and resurrection. And as we've gone through these latter stages of it, we've seen some, you know, just one thing after another. Just to take it just a little ways back, not even a full day back from where we are in our text today, but just sort of in the hours before, we look together at Jesus' powerful, fervent prayer on the Mount of Olives as after the Passover meal that he shared with his disciples. And he goes back, and his disciples are all, what were they doing? They were fast asleep. And Jesus has to wake them up so that they can be ready for the next event. And the next event is the coming of this big crowd with all kinds of weapons. And there in the lead of it is someone that the disciples thought were with them, but has snuck off and has become part of the group that's here to take Jesus. And he has set up a sign of betrayal, the way that he's going to identify Jesus. You wonder, what did it take for people to recognize Jesus? I guess at night it was hard. I don't know. But Jesus had been sitting in the temple day after day after day, at least as Luke describes it, and teaching the people. Maybe the people that would want to arrest him didn't get up very close to him. I don't know. As people came, as Luke tells us, from early in the morning to get spaces there in the temple court in order to listen to Jesus. But here now they have the leadership of one of his apostles, one of the 12 that represent the 12 tribes of Israel, and the betrayer tries to kiss Jesus to use that as a sign of who it is that they're supposed to arrest. And suddenly there's somebody draws their sword. John tells us that it was Peter that did it, but Luke decides to leave the person anonymous. They draw the sword and whoosh, off goes an ear of all things, falling to the ground, at least it would appear. And one of the high priest's servants is injured. And suddenly Jesus tells the disciple, whoever it was, to put away that sword. And he reaches and touches the man and heals him. Not exactly what you would expect when people are coming to arrest you and kill you. But that's what happens. The disciples, the rest of the group sort of evaporate, as it were. Jesus is bound and taken to the mansion, or the may have been almost a palace of the high priest. And Peter, the one who had said he would always be with Jesus, even to go to prison or to death, He wants to fulfill that, and he comes with Peter. But as Luke notes, he comes, follows a ways off. It seems that he wants to stay somewhat secret about this. Maybe it's that idea that was there, if John is correct, that it was Peter that pulled the sword, that really they needed to fight these people off at least for a little bit so that Jesus could get away. He couldn't have thought that with one sword he was going to overcome a whole platoon of people coming to arrest him. But he thought maybe that he could stave it off for a while so that Jesus could get away, could organize the people around him, could heal others and get it the situation strong and be able to come in as the anointed king and establish himself as king, the Messiah over the people of Jerusalem, and cast out the Romans and glorify the temple and so forth. But we, as you remember, we talked about last time, Peter goes there and we don't hear a word from Jesus. He's standing there in the courtyard of the high priest's mansion. And what Luke lets us see is Peter. And it goes on for quite a long time. As you remember, there's three times that Peter is asked if he belongs to the group around Jesus. There doesn't seem to be any danger. It's not as though I'm going to go tell the police and they're going to come and arrest you. No, they just ask. And Peter says, no, I'm not. No, I don't know him. I don't know him. I don't know what you're talking about. Maybe trying to keep his identity safe so maybe he can pull something off. But Jesus is standing there, and Jesus doesn't seem to be wanting him to do anything to free him. Jesus is present there. And when that last one comes, it's been over an hour that he's been sitting there with the soldiers around him and everything. And he finally says, I don't know what you're talking about. And as the words are coming out of his mouth, Luke tells us, a rooster crows. And he remembers what Jesus had said to him. It's as though he had forgotten. And only that, when Jesus, that rooster crows, a very significant thing happens. Jesus, over there on the other side of the courtyard, turns around, who should I look at, and looks at Peter. Doesn't say a word, just looks at Peter. And Peter remembers. And he just walks out the gate and starts weeping. It was true. He didn't know Jesus. He thought he was going to be the hero to deliver Jesus. But Jesus was not there to be delivered in that way. He was doing the delivering in a way that Peter could not yet grasp. In fact, none of his disciples evidently could yet grasp it. And it's then that Luke tells us that, well, the people that had bound Jesus and were holding him there decided they'd start having some fun, so they started beating him. This is not yet the priest. The high priest haven't woken up yet and had their servants wake them up yet. They're just off somewhere. But the soldiers that hold Jesus, they are not going to be deprived of their fun, and so they start beating Jesus, and then they say, I tell you what'll be fun. Let's blindfold him. He says he's a prophet. Maybe he can tell us who it is that's beating him. And so they do something, blindfold him, put a bag over his head, something like that, keep on beating him. Prophesy! Tell us who hit you. But then, sun rises, and the whole Sanhedrin, all of the leading Sadducees and Pharisees, the priests and all of the others, the scribes, come together. They lead Jesus from the house of the high priest, at least as Luke tells it, and they lead him inside the temple, probably not very far away. The two probably were pretty close. And there is a big room there that's inside the court of the Israelites in the temple for the Sanhedrin that was set to hold maybe 70, 80 people there in that. And they usher him in there. And then that little section that I included there on the backside of your sheet, they start questioning him. But it's just basically, not really questioning, it's just a demand. They say, if you yourself are the Messiah, the anointed one, the anointed king, if you are, tell us. Jesus says, if I tell you, you won't believe. And if I ask you questions, you won't answer. It's the same pattern that had been there when they came asking about Jesus' authority to do what he was doing. But then Jesus adds this other thing, this truth. And this truth involves going back and echoing the scriptures, that he can count on these priests and scribes and Pharisees and so forth to know, and to know the meaning of using these words when he does. He says, you know, if I tell you, you won't believe. If I ask you questions, you won't answer. Still, from now on, this is the reality. The Son of Man, that mysterious phrase, is going to be sitting at the right hand of the power of God. Now, if you know that the scriptures, the word Son of Man echoes Daniel 7, 13 and 14, the great vision that Daniel had of the Ancient of Days coming, and 10,000 times 10,000 angels are gathered around him. And he comes with thrones, plural. And they're all gathered before him. And there comes one like a Son of Man. Daniel has already had a vision of monsters. These represent all the human empires that are there. But this one who is the human being, the Son of Man, comes. And he's the one that receives glory and dominion and a kingdom that will never end. So all you have to do is just say that little phrase, Son of Man, and it carries all the accusations they could think of about Jesus with it right there by Jesus saying. Now, he doesn't say, I am the Son of Man. He just says, this is the truth of what reality. The Son of Man is going to be sitting at the right hand of the power of God. Now, there's already been a discussion of the passage that Jesus alludes to here, and that's the beginning of Psalm 110, as we've talked about it when we were looking at that. It's the most quoted verse of the Old Testament in the New Testament. And it is where the psalmist says, David says, the Lord, Yahweh, said to my Lord, almost always was interpreted to mean the Messiah, the coming heir of David, the son of David, the one whom God said, he will be to me a son, and I will be a father to him. That one is going to be seated. The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies the footstool of your feet. So in one sentence, just stating reality, Jesus has taken all their worst fears and expanded them, or all of their noblest and best hopes, and said, it's happening now. Daniel 7, 13 and 14, and Psalm 110, verse 1. And they get the point. When they respond, they don't echo those phrases. They say, then they all said, so you are the Son of God. That's the phrase that God, through the prophet Nathan, had used with David, that your son is going to build a temple for me, and he will be a son to me. So you're talking about a Davidic king. You're a Davidic king. You're the Son of Man, the one who receives the eternal kingdom, and you're exalted to the right hand of God. Jesus says to them, you yourselves are saying that I am. And he uses that phrase that is a quote from God's revelation to Moses. Tell them that I am sent you to them. In one sentence that they maybe only partially grasped and certainly feared as they looked at Jesus, he brings together all of this. These are people that know their scriptures. We're not going to have any more of that through the trial. This is off with the educated ones, the Sanhedrin. The rest of it's going to be a different crowd as the crowded ways of life sweep through these few hours here. The Son of Man, that with that eternal kingdom, though, is there. Jesus has asserted it, and he asserts it to us, you see, because he thinks that we will understand what Jesus says to the Sanhedrin, because we have our scriptures and we can look it up. So they understand enough to know that if they're going to stay in their positions running the temple of God, doing all the sacrifices with the flow of income that comes with that and the power and influence that comes with that they can't have somebody that has this crazy set of aspirations. He's going to cause trouble. He's a prophet that's going to be trouble. And we cannot stand for that. So they take him as the first part of the trial that we're looking at here in this passage, chapter 23, verses 1 through 25. They take him to the representative of all Roman power there in Jerusalem. That, of course, is Pilate, Pontius Pilate. He's of the equestrian status in the Roman Empire. Everybody is stratified in the Roman Empire. There's no idea of equality of human beings. But he's fairly high up. He's been appointed by Tiberius as the emperor, as the governor there in Judea. He was the governor from the year 26 to 36. We're at the year 30 right now in this text. And so he's been the governor there for about 4 years. But the key thing that he has that the people in the Sanhedrin want is he has authority. He has power. He has power to do what they need to have done to get rid of this person. He can execute people. He comes with the power of life and death. He comes with soldiers that are around him at all times. He comes with protection. He comes with enough soldiers to strike, not just to protect him, but to strike out. He can deal with unrest. He can deal with insurrection. Now, Pilate knows nothing about the Son of Man. He does not know anything about the Davidic king and the idea of the Son of God and all of those kinds of things. But he does know unrest and he does know insurrection. And as we learn later on in the story here, there has been probably in the last couple of days there as the Passover week is going on, there has been an insurrection in the city of Jerusalem. We don't know details about it, but we do know that one person that we get their name, Barabbas, was a leader in that. And others, probably the two that were crucified on both sides of Jesus, were also involved in that insurrection. And at least Barabbas was involved not only just in the insurrection, he was involved in killing somebody, probably a Roman, one would certainly think, and in some sort of battle, some street battle, or some maybe an assassination or whatever, he had killed someone. And so there had been unrest and there had been killing during that Passover that Jesus has just celebrated with his disciple. And Pilate has people in jail from that uprising that he wants to crucify, just as the high priests and the others think it's time to get rid of Jesus, and Pilate's the one who can crucify. Now, as you read about Pilate in this from a Christian point of view, it's easy because Pilate says some really interesting thing, that Jesus is not guilty and so forth, that he's done nothing wrong. And you might start thinking that Pilate's really quite a nice guy here, that he has a real sense of justice and everything. He can recognize an innocent person and tries to defend. You get turned a little bit upside down at the end of the story where he just gives over. Even though he thinks Jesus has done nothing wrong, he gives over to the desires of the crowd. But when we read, and I can remember the very first time, it's quite a long time ago now, that I read a particular document that was written in about 40 AD, in other words, about 10 years after Jesus' crucifixion. And it was, it's a document written, the whole document was written by a man named Philo of Alexandria, Philo the Jew, from a very wealthy Jewish family in Alexandria where there was rich community of Jews there. And but he was a scholar and a philosopher and so forth, but also a defender of Jewish rights in a great city like that. And he had headed up an embassy to go to the emperor who happened to be emperor at that time, namely Gaius Caligula, the sort of the famous one who started thinking that he himself was a god and demanded that everybody worship him as a god, and that he had decided so much that he was a god that he wanted in every synagogue in Alexandria for his own statue to be set up there. And he found out about the temple in Jerusalem, and he gives orders to his leading legate in Antioch that he wants his own colossal statue set up in the Holy of Holies in the temple in Jerusalem. Now that caused consternation beyond belief among the Jews in Israel. And Philo, one of the leading people of the group in Alexandria, led a delegation of Jews to Gaius. Now, it so happened that when Gaius became emperor, one of his best friends, you wouldn't believe this, but it's absolutely true so far as historical texts can tell us, one of his best friends was a man named Agrippa. Agrippa the First, King Agrippa the First, who was the king, who became king of the Jews. That was one of the things that happened when Gaius became emperor, that he made Agrippa a king of the Jews. And but Agrippa, he was reared in Rome. That's how he became friends with the young emperor. But he was reared in Rome as a hostage to make sure his family did not rebel against the Romans back in Israel. And he comes and is just coming to visit his friend there and finds out that he has said that there's got to be a colossal statue of me set up in the temple in Jerusalem. This is in the year 40. And as he describes, he wrote a letter. This is one of the most courageous things, if you know about Gaius. It didn't take anything for Gaius to kill you, because he was God. And he killed people right and left. And Agrippa knows that. But he lies almost catatonic for several days. And then he writes a letter to his friend, Gaius, pleading, arguing for him not to do this. That the Jews in Jerusalem and in Israel as a whole are so devoted to the law that they will die in their thousands rather than let them set this up. And so he writes this letter, and he argues and tells and cajoles and praises, of course, praises Gaius, who is just about to commit this awful crime and so forth. But one of the arguments that he uses is, looking back, he uses a story about Pilate. And Pilate, the way in which Pilate treated the people in Jerusalem and in the areas around there. And he's writing to the emperor in Rome, and he describes this Roman governor. And I can remember reading this because I had had fairly high evaluation, shall we say, of Pilate from the things that you read in the gospel, just because you just read them on the surface. But these are some of the sentences that Agrippa, the king, writes about this Roman governor to the emperor in Rome. Pilate was a man of very inflexible disposition and very merciless, as well as very obstinate. He talks about Pilate's corruption, his acts of insolence, his exploitation, his habit of insulting people. We've never seen anything like this, of course. His cruelty, his continual killing of people without trial or judicial condemnation, and his never-ending, gratuitous, and most grievous inhumanity. Those are the phrases that Agrippa uses. And as he's talking about another thing that Pilate did, he makes the observation that he did not wish to do anything which could be acceptable to his Jewish subjects. He hated the Jews. Now, he knew power, and he could get along with them, and he could manipulate them, people like Caiaphas, but he despised them. And so, he's the one who, not with purity of heart or anything like it, is saying, I don't find any guilt in this man. He's the one that's looking at the Sanhedrin, holding back the spit that he wants to throw at them, and saying, look, I don't find anything wrong with them. He wants to thwart them if he possibly can. And so when they bring this Jesus to him, he doesn't seem to have any very clear idea about him, about Jesus. But he does get from the people that, as you look at verse 2 of our reading today, there are three parts of their accusation: that he's corrupting the nation, he's forbidding paying tribute, taxes to Caesar. That's something that's not an easy thing to do. And claiming that he himself is Messiah, Mashiach, Christos. He's the anointed king. So that's the one that clicks for Pilate. So he looks at Jesus and he asks exactly one question. Are you Messiah? the King of the Jews. Now, all of the things that Jesus had said to the Sanhedrin would, you know, that was a kind of king. But it's a king who is king of the world, who receives an eternal kingdom that cannot be destroyed. He now puts it in the down-to-earth form that would indicate, are you part of the band that has been bringing about sedition here in the city and so forth? And then we have, within this whole trial, as far as Luke tells it, the only words that Jesus says. Not that some of the other Gospels don't give more, but this is what Luke wants us to see. And the only thing Jesus says is, you're the one saying that. I'm not saying that. He doesn't say that, but that's kind of implied. Those are not my words. Those aren't even the words over here from these people that have been accusing me. You're the one saying that. That's your reading on all of this. Now, Pilate knows rebels against Rome. They were often fierce. The zealots were growing. A lot of times they were scared. He could manipulate them and so forth. He could throw them in jail. He could crucify them. But Jesus clearly isn't that. And Luke focuses on these conflicting perceptions of Jesus. None accept Jesus' own reality that is summarized in those allusions to Scripture. They don't see anything from Jesus' point of view. They all see from their own point of view. Jesus is a pawn to be used to manipulate Pilate, for Pilate to manipulate them, right back. The priests add that Jesus' wide teaching here and there, all the way from Galilee down to Jerusalem, is inciting the people. But just the mention of Galilee sets Pilate off to pawn Jesus off to Herod Antipas. It is, after all, Passover, and Herod Antipas is a Jewish king in the northern part of that region, and not really a king. He presented himself as a king. He actually, as far as the Romans were concerned, he's a regional leader. They called that a tetrarch. But people called him king, King Herod Antipas. And so he sends him off to Herod. Wow. So what's going to happen? He doesn't particularly want to deal with this trivial person. I mean, Pilate doesn't, at least as it seems at that point. Herod is this Jewish regional leader of Galilee, and he's come to Jerusalem for the Passover. He's the one, you remember, that executed, cut off the head of John the Baptist at the desire of his stepdaughter. He has wanted to arrest Jesus. If you look back at Luke chapter 13, verse 31 to 33, you have one of those interesting little episodes in the gospel. It says, at that very hour, some Pharisees, of all things, came and said to Jesus, get away from here, for Herod wants to kill you. That's Herod, this Herod, Herod Antipas. And he said to them, go, tell that fox. Get a little bit of Jesus' edge toward Herod. Tell that fox, behold, I cast out demons and perform cures. He knew that Herod liked to see things that would manifest his power, which, you know, Herod took as being kind of magical power. I cast out demons and perform cures today and tomorrow, and the third day I finish my course. Nevertheless, I must go on my way today, tomorrow, and the day following, for it cannot be that a prophet should perish away from Jerusalem. And there's a little earlier in the gospel, there's another passage that's important where just before Peter confesses that Jesus is the Messiah of God, Jesus asks them what people are saying. And one of the things that comes up is what Herod is saying, Herod the Tetrarch. Herod the Tetrarch heard about all, this is in chapter 9, verses 7 through 9. Herod the Tetrarch heard about all that was happening, and he was perplexed because it was said by some that John had been raised from the dead. By this time, he's already killed John. By some that Elijah had appeared, and by others that one of the prophets of old had risen. Herod said, "John I beheaded, but who is this about whom I hear such things?" And he sought to see Jesus. He wanted to see proof. Are you really powerful? So Jesus comes to him, and he's happy as a lark. He maybe is going to get a sign done right in front of him to see the magic at work. Do you have power? Can you do stuff? Are you really powerful? So problematic dealing with Jesus. Jesus just stands there, absolutely silent. He doesn't say no, he doesn't say yes. He chooses, at least I take it, to enact one of those powerful verses in the song of the suffering servant in Isaiah. Isaiah 53, verse 7, "He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth, like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and like a sheep that before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth." Curiosity by Herod turns to contempt and mocking. He and his soldiers, his bodyguard around him, they get some fancy clothes and put on Jesus, sounds like he owns just one change of clothing, maybe not even that, just the ones that he wears, not even a change. And then Herod sends him back to Pilate. Now then there emerges this thing that has been really unexpressed in the background, namely that, yes, he's arrested these people for an insurrection, but there's this tradition that they have, this tradition of an amnesty at the feast, in which one person that would be put to death gets off, and the governor can give him freedom and let him go. So Pilate, he is there, and the priests and the rulers are there. All of them despise Jesus, and they despise each other. Now, he knows that the priests and the rulers despise Jesus and want Jesus executed. And from his point of view, they're using me, they're using Pilate to get their job done. But Pilate knows that Jesus is not like these other insurrectionists that were rebels and had committed murder in the city. He probably knows, if he's been there for any number of days, that people have been crowding around Jesus, as Luke has told us, to hear him. They want to hear this prophet Jesus. So now there is a way that he can thwart these leaders of the Jews. Use that Passover amnesty custom. Pilate can fulfill the amnesty by releasing the popular prophet, and he can thwart those aristocratic priests and thereby feel free without any consequences to execute, to crucify one of those who has rebelled against Rome in the city, even committed a murder in the city. Pilate has no interest in justice, no care about Jesus, but he's in a continual power struggle with any local leaders who can undermine his status and his power. He wants to crucify Barabbas, and the best way to do that is to get the amnesty taken by Jesus. So he'd much prefer to release Jesus and not Barabbas. But the Jewish crowds, They like Jesus, maybe, but they hate the Romans. And they admire the rebels more than a prophet. Given an opportunity to free a rebel brave enough to kill Romans, they'll give up on Jesus. You see how that works? So they insist and cry. And there's about to be an uprising taking place right there in front of Pilate's Pilate's own palace, where he does his governing work. And the outcry gets more and more and more. And the high priests and the teachers, they are urging on the crowd. They want their hero who has fought against the Romans, who is a heroic rebel against them, who has actually killed some Romans. They want him to be the one that's released. There are no heroes in this story. Luke, though, as he tells it, at least I think, allows us as we're watching. Remember, Luke is writing not to these people that are in the story, but to us, readers out later. Allows us to see this Barabbas. What does the name Barabbas mean? Have you ever looked that up? The name means son of a father. That's about as generic. How many men here are sons of a father? Most all of us have fathers, mothers too, of course, but this name happens to be with Abba, the name that Jesus used for the father, Bar, meaning son, Barabbas. Son of a father. So he's got a name that's sort of like Theophilus at the beginning of Luke, the one that's beloved by God. He's a son of a father. And Luke kind of allows us to see Barabbas become a kind of parable to illuminate what happens. And as you watch, as the things unfold here, Jesus takes his human place as a son of a father on a cross. Jesus does it without saying a word. He does it without confronting Pilate with his injustice, without standing forcefully against the false things said about him. And I wish there were speeches of Jesus. That's what I want at his trial. I want to hear his testimony and hear all about it. We get the one statement. You yourself are saying that. And that's it. But still, in the sinfulness of everybody there, as the crowded ways of life cross, this one name comes to the fore. This human who would have been crucified. And Pilate, when he sees that he's likely to have on his hands a riot against him, that can undermine his status and people can take that back to Rome with accusations. He decides that, lo and behold, his verdict is not going to be according to what's just. It's going to be according to what's convenient, what they're demanding. Jesus takes Barabbas' human place on a cross. He takes all of his wrongs, all the misdirection of Israel. He takes the priests' hatred. He takes the crowd's fickleness. He takes Pilate's cowardly injustice. He takes the disciples' failures and denials. He takes me. He takes you. He takes all of us. He goes all the way into our death in order to give us life. To give it to all of them and to give it to us. And the one that is used there is someone explicitly who has committed murder, who has killed someone, and Jesus dies for the killer and all of the others. He is that one, like the suffering servant, who bears our sins and carries our sorrows, and with his wounds, we are healed. Amen.